Welcome, Dr. Walsh. Your research over so many years has focused on genetics and epigenetics. What are they, and why do they matter? And what's the difference between them?
Now, epigenetics, that's something really, really important. For example, we all have similar genes. We all have DNA. And every part of your body has identical DNAs. Your liver, your skin, your eyeballs, it's all the same exact DNA. But what does DNA do for you? And once you're developed and it's got your eye color and your height and all of those things, its main job is it makes important proteins. 80,000 proteins. I call it the genetic restaurant. Now, the problem is your skin needs some of these and not some of the others. And every major cell line, and there's more than 200 of them, they have to have different combination of chemicals. And that's epigenetics does that. And it's incredibly important. And it's the epigenetics of our society is changing with time. And it allows us, it's epigenetics that allows us to change the rate. We developed a therapy for people who are low serotonin, who might have depression or might have obsessive compulsive disorder. And we know how we can adjust serotonin activity because of epigenetics. We've learned how the factors that cause a gene to express, and we can do that a lot with epigenetics. So the people I'm training now, we've advanced a lot in 5 years, and a lot of this is epigenetics. And so now we have the ability to take a patient who might have been suffering from depression or whatever, and by doing a good medical history and getting some minimal but very important lab tests, we can identify what neurotransmitters are misbehaving. That's what mainstream psychiatry can't do. So they do their best, and with all these medications and all, but it's mostly a trial and error thing. And of course, they're thrilled every time they get a new medication. It's a huge industry. And that's one of the problems. Fortunately, there's been enough basic science that now we're understanding more and more how the brain works.
And what started you working on these ideas? What kept you persisting all that time to achieve your goal?
When I started doing this, my mother sent me a letter saying that if I could help just one child, all my work will be worth it. See, my issue is I've worked with 30,000 patients myself directly, and with the other doctors I've been working with, we now have more than 1.5 million patients have done our protocols. We now understand much better why some people are prone to drugs, cocaine, heroin, and all the others. And there is a certain neurotransmitter abnormality associated with that. And now for the first time, we are able to train our doctors how to take a person, maybe a child who might be prone to it or starting on it, or even a person who's an addict. We now have the ability with nutrient therapy to really help a lot of these people.
And how did you do that?
It's all sort of brand new, but there's a lot of solid science and articles published. I'm just saying this is an example of how we learn as we get smarter and as science improves. It's sort of a gradual thing. It's not something we discovered 20 years ago and we're trying to get everybody to do it. We're trying to improve everything. I've always been tormented by the people who didn't get better. They did everything. They complied with everything we did and they didn't get better. I've done a lot of studies of that. I always did studies trying to understand why. And we got to the point where we've got some of the answers. And I think it's just a gradual advancement of both experience and knowledge. There is a reason for everything, and things are not that mysterious and complicated. And we just have to dive in and find out what the reality is. And one of the challenges, of course, is individuality. Every human being is totally different unless they're identical twins. And those differences are striking. And it can be genetic, but even epigenetic. And then that's the real challenge, is to look at the individual. You got people coming to me saying, hey, what's a really good multiple vitamin? They want me to tell them what would be really good. And the answer is, it depends on who you are.
A lot of your recent work has involved methylation as a key part of how epigenetics work.
There are some people we know that are under-methylated, and you might be familiar with that, and they thrive on a protein diet. And they better not get too much folate, or they're going to be prone to really low serotonin levels. And then there are other people who have a different kind of a methylation disorder, and they need a vegetable diet. So even diet, it depends on your individuality.
I think you mentioned St. John's wort as another example.
It's good for undermethylated people, people whose DNA has low content of methyl groups. And they're the ones who, and because they are prone to low serotonin activity. So that's why St. John's wort helps significantly that group, but not the rest of the world. We're getting to understand a lot of this.
So does that mean that depending on a person's epigenetic and methylation profile, the same treatment can produce very different results?
I would say that the first thing, if they knew about it, they could see one of the doctors that we've trained. They're now everywhere. We've got thousands of them in the United States now, I think, and they're scattered around the world. And so this is a doctor who could do a medical history of a child who's having a problem, whatever that problem is, and could do a few lab tests that might cost them $400 or $500. That's not that much. You might get insurance even. And they'll be able to understand what's wrong. And if it's ADHD, our outcome studies show that we're 85% correct. We can really help 85%. And the truth is 15% don't get better because they have something else wrong. I mean, everybody doesn't get better. And if for violent behavior, that's what we're really good at. That's about a 90%. And we've published a few articles showing that.
What do you mean by there being different kinds of depression?
Depression, there's all different kinds of depression. I discovered with our depression group that there are five completely different types of depression. And I gave this talk at the American Psychiatric Annual Meeting, and I remember there were like 800 psychiatrists listening to me, basically explaining that they shouldn't just start giving people antidepressants. They should do a few lab tests and find out their individuality, and that will guide them to which medications might be better. I also suggested there are some other epigenetic nutrient things they could do where they might not need the medication. We are not opposed to medication, anything that helps a patient live better. But if we get a patient who's on heavy medication, and maybe they've got more depression, anxiety, or whatever, what we do is we go through our process and we design a nutrient therapy that will attempt to correct the misbehaving neurotransmitters, and we insist they continue their medication for at least 3 or 4 months. And do both together. And then after they get better, then attempt to wean themselves away from the medication. In the case of ADHD and people taking Adderall and all those, we've learned that it's about 85% of the families say they're at their very best with zero medication. And maybe 10 or 15 say, well, it looks like we lose something when we stop taking. And we say, so be it. They've reduced it, whatever works. So that's our general approach. We're not against medications.
How did medications become so important in psychiatry?
Medications have helped many people. It's interesting how medications first came about. Back in the 1950s and 60s, up until then, all the psychiatry thought that if a person had depression or schizophrenia or whatever, that it was all due to life experiences. Sort of the John Locke tabula rasa thing, where they thought that a person's behavior and personality was written on a blank slate from their experiences. Well, 1950s and 60s, the scientists found out that the number one predictor of depression is if there was a family history of depression. And we had these great tests and studies, including identical twins and all. And it proved that really inborn problems, they were the number one reason was they had something misfiring or some malfunctioning of their brain. Well, this is awful for psychiatrists. Now their profession is saying, oh, I'm sorry, but that's not what's really wrong. And they knew that they had to do something to change neurotransmissions, some of them. And there's 40 different major neurotransmitters. So what they did was the only thing they could do, the only weapon they had were drugs. So they started doing Haldol, Prolixin, Thorazine, and all of these things, and got some benefits because they found that putting them on a couch and talking to them had limited benefits. And they were able to really help some people. And that's how it started. But now it's grown to be almost like a monster.
What's the best way for people to learn more so that they can make informed decisions regarding treatment options and epigenetics, other than online research, of course?
If it's depression or behavior or something, they might start looking at the book Nutrient Power. I get a lot of it is in there, at least to get them started with what's possible. But there are a lot of great doctors out there that were not involved with us that understand this. Functional medicine people, there's now hundreds of thousands of functional medicine people in the USA. The whole field of genetics is really expanding. It's only been a few years that they actually coded all of the genes. There are 20,000, and it's been recent they finally found what they all really are. But the important thing are the collaborative team of genes. Like we found there are 400 genes that collaborate to enable brain function. Heart function is something like 1,500 genes collaborate for the heart to function, and there's immunity. And so people really haven't looked at the family of genes, and because that you can have weakness in at birth, a genetic weakness. And then when you have the continual daily DNA damage that we all have, it's those weaknesses that usually become apparent, and that's why a person might develop cancer, heart disease, schizophrenia, or whatever. It's really great to understand this. So we don't do DNA testing, but what we're doing is we're watching the great advances in genetics. This is coming. I mean, they are advancing so fast. The DNA scans they talk about now are, you know, not even 0.5% of finding all the information that's hidden in our DNA. And that's coming.
You've recently done some groundbreaking research and written a book explaining how you found the causes of bipolar disease. You say that you now know how to prevent the progression, even stop it, if found early enough, right?
Working on studying neuroscience and genetics and epigenetics for nearly 10 years about bipolar, which has always been a great mystery in psychiatry. Nobody knows what it is or why it is or what's the cause. And what's exciting to me is I've discovered the cause of bipolar. And knowing that, that led to the discovery of why people cycle between mania and depression. We've also, based on this, found out that there are treatments that have been ignored and real good possibilities for prevention. Supposed to be 70,000 people with this nasty, terrible disease. And we've learned some things, some new therapies that can help everybody to some degree now. And as soon as a psychiatrist would, for example, would read that, they know what to do. Now, this is complicated in bipolar because bipolar is the most heritable of all disorders. It runs a family stronger than anything else. But for 30 years, they were not able to find even one gene that seemed to be connected. But they now understand that there are a multitude of small effect genes. And one by one, starting in 2008, they've been finding some of these genes that are connected to it. I, about 4 years ago, got to 64 of them. And they have these groups now throughout the world that are doing studies of late onset diseases like bipolar and cancer. They're doing genetic studies trying to identify predisposing genes.
So it's like having all the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. How did you make sense of it?
So now we have these genes, and so myself and hundreds of others are looking at these individual genes, recognizing that there might be 1,000 of them, but we've seen the first 64, so everybody's trying to understand what can this give a clue to what this mysterious disease is. And I think that I've developed the right way to analyze the data. I was able to identify what genes are dominant in bipolar. I found that there are actually two genetic predispositions. And the second one was a surprise. Basically, the predisposition is that people with bipolar are born with a weakness in the team of ion channel genes that are attached to your brain neurons. And they orchestrate everything that happens in your brain. And so some people are born with that weakness. But the other thing that was a big surprise, they also have accelerated DNA damage. They have DNA damage that is relentless beginning the day they're born. So we can't do much about fixing the ion channels, but we can do something about the DNA damage. We can do advanced antioxidant therapy. So we can help psychiatrists with a patient or anyone treating a patient. Now we'll know that they can actually give them some significant benefit from fixing that. But for prevention is what's really exciting, because within about 10 or 15 years, genetics is growing so fast. The world will be able to take a newborn baby or a young child, and all of this information is hidden in their DNA strands. And they'll be able to identify people who have weaknesses in certain cell lines, which might make them prone to cancer or heart disease or kidney disease or schizophrenia.
And how do you expect doctors to be able to detect and help people with bipolar disorder?
That's going to be known. So we're going to identify people who have the tendency for bipolar. And what happens is that these predispositions aren't enough to cause it when they're children or adolescents. it takes really year after year of accelerated DNA damage, which creates new mutations. And it gets to the point where you get the onset of bipolar. And basically, I've done an analysis of this wonderful new data that just came out. I've done a unique analysis of it. That's how I discovered what the cause is. It's really quite clear. How do you fight an enemy if you don't know who or what it is? I think it really is going to be a great help to now understand what it is. It's going to guide better treatments. And I think one of the greatest treatments is going to be to eliminate this accelerated DNA damage, which, by the way, is also why we age. It's the cause of aging. It's the cause of cancer. It's the cause of most human maladies. And it's really major in bipolar disorder. But that's something we can stop in its tracks. Okay. We can prevent it from developing. Once you have the onset of this complex disorder, it really cannot be reversed. We can keep it from getting worse.
And how do you do that?
Bipolar is famous for somebody who develops this at age 20. I've seen more than 1,000 cases. Our treatments, in our case, a lot of nutrient therapies, a lot of them become really quite well. But these very same people, if they're 40 or 50, these treatments don't work nearly as well. And if somebody had been suffering for 50 years and had more additional DNA damage, it's really hard to help them at all. So I think this is something that's really important. And we have families now that we're working with that the father and the mother both have bipolar. And the statistics are 75% chance the child will have bipolar. We have some of those families. So now we're going to start contacting them because we know how to prevent it. So it won't be 75%, but maybe 0 or 1%. It'll prevent them from getting the disorder. So that's really exciting.
Finally, can you tell me about your new book?
So anyway, we're excited about the book. And most books of this sort are sold for like $200 or $300. Ours is going to cost $32. And we were even going to do Kindle, and we want the information to get out there. Our goal is not to make a lot of money. We want this information to get out there. The book is going to be coming out on October 21. And we want the world to know that there's this study that apparently has discovered the cause and the explanation for the cycling, this condition that only happens in bipolar. And so I want a lot of people to look at the book, especially scientists and bipolar experts. There's all these people suffering. And I think that this is a great chance to help.
Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Walsh.